At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Member Week is here at Lowe's. Don't miss your chance to get up to 40% off hundreds of items like paint, faucets, vanities, doors, and more. Shop our exclusive deals happening in-store and online now through July 18th. Not a member? Join My Lowe's Pro Rewards for free today and get ready to save more. Lowe's, we help you save. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Today on The Grave Talks, Closer to Death, the conversation with Joe Pieri. The world of paranormal investigative work has been going through an evolution since its inception. From disembodied voices being heard over the original telephone line, to analog recording, to parts from modern video game machines being used to capture the presence of the dead, the space between the living and the beyond continues to thin. Just how clear will that threshold become? That's what we talk about today with paranormal investigator Joe Pieri.
It's funny you say, I'm going to date myself on this now. It started back in high school with me when we had to graduate from high school. We had to write a thesis and we had to apply it to a library. And we had mentors throughout the year. And my mentor was my science teacher. We had a nickname for him. We used to call him Einstein because he had enormous red hair that he never combed. And he believed in just let it flow because it wasn't important. The important thing to him was just learning about science. He didn't care about anything else. He was my mentor. It happened in May when I was kind of in a pickle. I couldn't think what I wanted to do. And he told me to think outside the box. Don't give me a thesis that's based on anything that we studied in school, if you want to do like a literature or mathematics. He goes, I want you to think outside the box. And I always had a fascination with the paranormal, the odd and unusual, mediumship, the abilities of what our brains are capable of doing and what we're only allowing it to do. So I decided to do it on the paranormal, the odd and unusual. Wow. It took me about 30 days to write the paper. Mm-hmm. And when it was complete, my science professor approached me and said that he enjoyed the paper, but he just couldn't let me get in front of a class of 300 people and explain why I wrote this paper. He says, you'll be labeled, and you don't want that. You're going into college now. You don't need this on your back. I agreed with him, but he did approach me and say, if you're really this interested in it, he told me that he did paranormal research. He investigated it, and he took me on my very first investigation at the age of 17. I was hooked from day one. I found it to be amazingly fascinating just because of the point. It was different. It wasn't the usual. We went in with tactics that are now called old school, and I enjoyed it. We actually got to witness something that night, too. And from that moment on, all the way through college, afterwards, all the way up to this point, I've been in the paranormal. I believe I've been in the spiritual, the odd and unusual. I even like oddities. Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating a venture. Do I have any regrets? Absolutely not. I think I've lost some family members and friends along the way, but you know, that comes with the territory. I don't think that they think I'm weird. I just think that they're afraid of it. They don't want to be associated with it. They're involved with the Hollywood aspect of things, like voodoo. If you stick a pin in, you're going to hurt somebody. That's not the case. And it's the same thing with the paranormal, odd and unusual.
Sure. So when you have this fascination, you write this paper, you start digging into it. What sort of background did you have? Did you have experiences in childhood or anything, or was it just more so, this is interesting, I want to find out more about this?
I did have something when I was a child, but I think 90% of the people in this field had something like that.
Sure.
I don't know if it was a dream or it was real. I did see a shadow mass leaning over my sister when she was sleeping in bed. I didn't know what it was, but when I called out for it, it sprung up and vanished. And that was the beginning of it. But other than that, I think I was the type that loved the fall, the leaves blowing, the scary stories, stuff that's unusual, like don't go into this room because it's haunted.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the guy that would say, oh, I have to go into this room now.
Yeah.
And it was the oddball in the class. I wasn't into, you know, the typical stuff where people were getting excited about the prom. I was getting excited about building a paranormal team, building paranormal gear at the time.
Sure.
And it's just who I am. I love the research end of things. I think that's more fascinating to me than actually seeing the entity. To build a history case onto something, I can go on and on about all of my point of views of the paranormal, but the number one thing for me has to be just the diehard research, not to prove, just so I know. Mm-hmm. I think it's more of a personal journey at this point, and it's funny because someone had asked me yesterday, well, you know, are you getting tired of proving the paranormal?
Mm-hmm.
And I replied, I think I'm past that. I'm more about the experiences now. It's more of a personal journey. I'm over 50 years old now. I'm on the back nine, so of my life, and that's where I am at this point. Now, for the younger generation, geez, I always say, open up, let it roll, try to prove it. We laid the roadwork down. It's clear and free. It's time for you to take the journey, and hopefully, they can discover what the truth is about all this.
What was your mission at first when you started digging into this in a serious outlook?
I'm going to have to say to prove it. Back in the 80s and 90s, it wasn't like today where some people are looking to get a TV show or something like that. It was more of helping an individual. So if you got a call from someone saying they're experiencing this, you didn't advertise what you were going to do. You rolled in real quiet. And it was helping the people. It was putting their minds to rest. Hopefully, we didn't use the word debunk. We were trying to prove or disprove the mm-hmm. type of hauntings that they were experiencing. And I'll be honest with you, 85% of what we investigated, we were able to lay down, you know, a list saying, it's not paranormal. This is what we believe it is. And it's kind of rewarding when it comes to that point because you can see the stress just drain out of the people.
Mm-hmm. When you had said that you did have something, you weren't sure if it was a dream or if it was something. Can you expound upon that in your childhood experience as to kind of that spark? I'd be interested in hearing what that experience was exactly, whether or not you view it as truly paranormal or just something that really, you know, kind of sparked you.
I was a young boy. At that time, you don't know what you're seeing.
Sure.
But when I was, I don't know, I was very protective of my sister. And when I saw this figure, and it had no definition to it, and I think that's what startled me the most. It didn't look like my parents. It didn't look like an actual human. It just looked like if someone were to take like a plastic garbage bag that's maybe 8 feet tall and drape it on a hanger. That's what I saw. It was something like that, but it was bent over my sister. My sister was sound asleep, but it was within a couple of feet of her face.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw this, I was really concerned. And I remember sitting up, looking at it and saying, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
And it sprung up so fast, and it looked like it actually shrunk down and shot up and disappeared. It's a very, if it was a dream, and I remember it this clearly, God, I wish I can still dream like that. I just can't prove that it was something real, because again, I was young. A young mind can wander, but it seemed to have left a very strong imprint on me.
Sure. When you look back on this now, I mean, it almost sounds, you know, as what we would describe as like a shadow type person. What do you view it as in hindsight?
I'm going to have to agree with you. I think what we look at as a shadow person today, it's very close to what I saw. It was dark in certain areas and it was cloudy in others. I mean, a shadow figure to me is something that absorbs energy.
Mm-hmm.
It absorbs light. That's why we get that shadow effect.
Sure.
And I'm going to have to classify it probably as a shadow person. Back then, I just called it the black bag that hovered over my sister.
Sure. No, I mean, and when you're a kid, I mean, you don't, it's not like, you know, shadow person is in the regular, you know, vernacular. It's like, hey, today on Sesame Street, the letter B and shadow people. It wasn't exactly how we were taught. So as that being an experience, you get deeper and deeper into this. Let's talk about, you know, some of the old, you know, old school versus new school ways of looking at paranormal investigation. When you started to get into it in the 80s and 90s, and we're digging deeper and deeper, you know, paint the picture for people. I mean, there's a lot of folks, it amazes me because it makes me feel older. I'm nearing the 40 mark, but, you know, you have some of the young folks in their, you know, late teens, early 20s who are diving into it, who know no world other than having ghost boxes and, you know, all the more modern type equipment. Paint the picture, explain to us, I mean, I know, but explain to the audience what the world was like back then in terms of trying to get into investigating the paranormal, trying to find evidence. What were some of the more compelling things that you would do or use and tactics of the day?
Sure. In the 80s, we didn't investigate at night. I'm not sure where that came into play. I'm guessing around the late 90s, early 2000s, about the night thing. We would arrive at a home approximately about 3 p.m. in the afternoon, and we would sit with the family with pure daylight, and we would charge the people back in the 80s due to the fact that the cost of having a roll of film developed, we used to call it, you want a 12, 24, or 36 investigation. And what that meant is, how many pictures do you want us to take and have developed for you?
Okay.
How many cassette recorders do you want? Do you want 1 hour? Do you want 2 hours? Do you want 3 hours of recordings?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that, where we didn't have the night vision capabilities. We didn't sit in the dark because we wanted to see what was there. We wanted to use the VHS tapes that we had the big clumpy camera with. We wanted to experience the paranormal. It's kind of fascinating. From today, back then, an EMF detector didn't exist.
Sure.
It basically, I mean, Ghostbusters in 1984 gave us, I think, the first EMF detector by the thing that opened up.
Sure.
And I think everyone started mild with that. But in 86 to 89, we didn't have anything like that. We would use a compass. A compass is based on the same theory as electromagnetic field,
mm-hmm.
But they would disrupt the magnetic field. There's no electrical part to it, just the magnetic field. And the needle wouldn't spin around. It would just start to bob up and down. So if you had a good 4-inch compass sitting on the table in front of you and you're explaining to the spirits how to use it, how to communicate, and they would actually pick that up pretty easy because they would just approach it and you would see the needle bob up and down.
Mm-hmm.
I actually still use some of this stuff because, again, I'm in my 50s. It's hard for me to break away from the stuff that I know that works.
Sure.
And I mean, if you're talking on an old cassette recorder, you're 30 minutes each side. You can never reuse that tape. And a lot of people say, well, didn't you get the noise of the mechanicus of the recorder? Absolutely. but you would have extended microphones. Depending on the society you were with, if it was a university, which most paranormal societies resided in, they would have a certain amount of funding to experiment with unusual findings. And they would invest in the cameras. They would invest in maybe a little bit more of a reel-to-reel cassette player. But you're carrying this 40-pound item into a home, looping up some reels and recording on that. Back in the 80s, and it all started in the 70s with the reel-to-reel. But in the 80s, they went to the mini cassettes. It was a little bit more affordable. But the group that I was associated with was with the University of Buffalo. Mm-hmm. And they had some pretty decent gear. And it's, to me, analog, I still think is better than digital. Digital is a processing. It records your voice, it digitalizes, it puts it on the flash drive, and you're done. Analog is actually embedded into the tape itself. Mm-hmm. You get a better response through analog. I believe you do. That's why Hans Holzer used to use the reel-to-reel all the time. He believed in analog, and even up to 2009 when he passed, he still believed in analog recordings. We would use stuff like that. We would, like today, static energy is making a rebound. It got away from us. Mm-hmm. And part of my paper states that I believe that the entities consume raw static energy. That's how they manifest themselves. It's almost like a black hole. They absorb it, it shows itself, and it emits more of an EMF, magnetic field. It's like us breathing in oxygen, exhaling carbon dioxide. I believed it was similar to them, but with a certain type of frequency and a magnetic field. And we used to use styrofoam cups as a Van de Graaff generator. As simple as that. And now in the summertime, it wouldn't work as well. But during the fall, winter weather, you can have the dry conditions outside. And you walk across a carpet, and your feet are dragging, and you can shock somebody. But you were to take a styrofoam cup, you're going to rub it on your sleeve until it sticks to your hand. That cup is statically charged. You start throwing these cups around. The entity will actually come through the room. It will collect the energy off the cups. Now, with it being styrofoam at a light weight, these cups used to swirl up, and sometimes they would actually stick to the masses of the entity. Mm-hmm. You would actually see a manifestation, because now it's absorbing the cups. It would last maybe 20 seconds, and the cups would fall silent because they consumed all the raw energy associated to the cup. But we used to use that. We used to use ping pong balls on top of the cup when you turn it upside down, and the ball would start to circle around from the static being pulled off the cup. It's kind of fascinating. Today we use props. We give them all these toys to use to get their attention and to have them perform for us. But back in the day, these were simple products that we used to use in the paranormal. And it's still used today. I actually teach it in my classes here at the store. And I do sell old school props as well. And I used to tell people, you can go to the dollar store and become a paranormal investigator with $5 in your hand.
Sure. When you look at all this stuff, retrospectively, and we can get into some of the new stuff a little bit further in the conversation, but what do you think the spirits, the world of ghosts, and I know this is such a generic term because there's the ghost family tree, I think, is extremely vast, but in terms of something gathering up the energy to manipulate something, let's talk about analog tape for a moment versus digital. You had brought that up. What exactly do you believe is the difference there in terms of them being able to communicate via analog of a magnetic tape versus a digital product of some sort? Is it something to do with the physicality of the magnetic tape that's actually, you can look at that microscopically as having an imprint put on it to produce the sound waves?
Yes, I do. It's the same thing with like a vinyl record. It's actually embedded in the tape itself. A digital is just a layer, and a layer can be manipulated. If you have a voice recorder that does a little bit of popping, it can actually sound like a voice coming through. And again, with like flash drives, people don't realize the thumb/flash drive have an expiration on them. Mm-hmm. You might put all your data onto a little thumb drive, and all of a sudden you go to plug it in, and it's not there.
Sure.
With tape, it stays on the tape. Mm-hmm. It's embedded in the tape. That's why I used to tell people you can never reuse a tape. Even though you can tape over it, you can put layers on a cassette, you're definitely going to get contamination from the layer below. It's just a event. Even Tesla used to record things in a magnetic field with the Tesla radio. Mm-hmm. He believed in that as well. Even though he didn't have the digital, he was very thorough about spirit communications. There's something about a cassette. Even if you take like a 1980s rock band and you play that cassette in your recorder, or you play the cassette in your cassette recorder,
yeah,
you do get a little hiss with it. You do get a little noise with it. That's because there's zero filters also applied to it. With voice recorders, there has to be at least a dozen to two dozen filters layered on everything you do. So if you go out and buy a high-end voice recorder and it says crystal clear audio, mm-hmm, you don't want that. The reason for that, because once someone starts talking, that voice recorder locks into that frequency. You have the two people, and what it does, it blocks out everything else. It's almost like a noise canceling. That's what digital does. Analog, with the hiss on it, it could be anything, and it's going to record it. It could be a disembodied voice. It could be a chirp. It could be your stomach growling. It could be whatever it is. It'll focus on that, and it will put it on the tape. There's no filters to say, nope, I don't want to put that because I'm a high-end,
yeah,
you know, cassette. That's why I still enjoy using it. It's expensive today because now you're looking at a two-pack of cassettes is almost $20-$25.
My God.
It's crazy.
I have not bought a cassette in probably 20-some years, but they used to be, those were dollar store items sometimes. They weren't the best from the dollar store, but they worked. Mm-hmm. But you could get your 60-minute or 90-minute, you know, Maxwell tapes for a couple bucks. But I suppose not many folks are necessarily using them anymore. Are there any, in your opinion, are there any advantages to digital versus the analog? I know you have a lot of arguments for analog versus digital, but are there any things that you do look at with digital and go, this seems to be able to do this part better than that?
Cost.
Okay. Cost. Other than one. Cost?
You can reuse a voice recorder thousands of times,
sure,
before it starts to go.
Okay.
That's number one. The portability, it's smaller. It's easier to carry. Stuff like that. Don't get me wrong. You can buy a high-end like SD card, something that can hold high gigs. I think they rate them from 1 to 10. There's different classes. The higher, the better.
Sure.
You can actually see it all depends on the voice recorder. I always tell people, don't spend a lot on a voice recorder. And the reason for, because if you pay a lot of money for something, that means there's filters, there's programs included with that. You want to get something as cheap as possible where the manufacturer says, don't worry about all those filters. Mm-hmm. Just put it out there. We're going to sell it the way it is because you want to be able to capture everything. Mm-hmm. And everyone knows about the Panasonic DR60, the most phenomenal voice recorder out there from 1998. They made a voice recorder that recorded at 5 dB and it would pick up people's voice at a very rough digital imprint, but it also would pick up disembodied voices, and they thought it was defective. Lo and behold, they didn't realize what they had on their hands. They had a gold mine, and they stopped manufacturing it. That's why people are out there paying $3,000 a voice recorder for this. It actually picks up a lot of the voices. And people ask me, well, what's the closest thing out there? There's an old Olympus recorder that almost does the identical thing. I also tell people you can go to any online store and buy the inserts that you would put into a teddy bear to record your message if you wanted to do that. If you had a child and you want to say, this is daddy, I love you so much,
yeah,
and squeeze the belly. Buy something like that because that recorder I can guarantee you has zero filters on it. It's something as simple as that. It records 30 seconds. You can erase it. You can keep using it over and over again. Mm-hmm. And you'll be surprised the quality of EVPs you get off of that little tiny device, because it's going to pick up the low decimals. It's going to pick up the noise around you. It's not going to say, I don't think I want to pick up that voice. I'm just going to concentrate on the person talking into it. It might pick up something off in the distance. And what I mean off in the distance doesn't mean someone who's 5 feet away. It means a different frequency, because everything's recorded on frequencies. And I mean, we base the whole field on frequencies.
Sure.
And you want to be able to record at all frequencies. You don't want to say, okay, we're in this frequency, we're only going to record in this one. And that's what that offers. They're $10. They're cheap, but they work.
Sure. When you talk about that, and you talk about these things that as technology has progressed, they've found ways to filter out the unwanted frequencies that probably 99% of their customers wouldn't really want when they're trying to use a digital voice recorder. They're trying to just get the clear audio of what is directly in front of it. But with this, you're wanting more so broad spectrum and things that are not going to be just perfectly there, not condensed down, not overprocessed. Is that the same when we're talking about film versus digital photography or video? Is there an argument to be made there?
Again, film is magnetic in the beginning, the VHS tapes, the same thing.
Sure.
But the difference with video, there's more layers on it because you have audio and video. I would lean more towards the digital, because when you put like cassette recorder, it's one layer, it's all audio. Mm-hmm. And a VHS, you have different layers. You're going to have your audio, you're going to have video, and that takes up a lot. And sometimes when it mixes, you get those pops and blurps and distortions. It just comes with it, with the territory, with video, with the analog tapes. I would actually lean towards the video, because right now, if we can shoot in 4K, that you can't beat 4K, because you can zoom in. So if I'm shooting at someone who's 60 feet away, that video is going to be able to pick up people who are maybe 25 feet away. And if you think it wasn't human, you can actually zoom in and you can see the quality at 4K. Yeah, we're so much better off on the video aspect of things now than we were back then.
So the digital has actually been an improvement in terms of getting resolution and picking things up. Does it pick things up better, in your opinion? I mean, obviously, resolution-wise, you can see things, but is there any advantage when you look back onto analog and being a magnetic medium as far as getting some things that may not be on the spectrum that a digital would be picking up?
No, everything's the same. Video is video.
Okay.
With the audio, you might pick up a little bit more audio, but you're layering it. And once you start layering onto some kind of tape, and that's all it is, it's just magnetic tape that you record digital images to, or yeah, audio images to, it gets distorted. It's going to be corrupt. You can never take a VHS tape and say, well, I caught these voices, because you don't know if it's just a layer from the person who was talking. Sometimes it'll double it up. And I always say, when you watch certain old movies, you'll get crackling and it'll get a voice get in there like, wah, 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 and then you'll hear them talk again. That's the way that works. There's too much layers. Again, with the video we have today is second to none. You're talking at least 30 megapixels, 50 megapixels, 100 megapixels. You can't beat that. I mean, when we first started this back just 10 years ago, we were talking 2 to 4 megapixels was out of this world.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're putting in more megapixels, more millions and millions of little dots that we can zoom in and actually see great detail. Yeah, we're in a great age for video. We truly are, and it's only going to get better. I think the next thing is going to be more of a, almost like a 3D hologram type of video, and I think that would help us in this field. But I think they're heading that way. 8K is starting to break the market. 8K will give you that, where if you were to look at a TV screen and you look at the angle, you would see the side of the person. meaning almost as if the person is 3D standing in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're going now. So instead of looking at a two-dimensional screen in front of you, it's almost going to be a three-dimensional where it's going to project out of the screen, and you're going to be able to see the side of the person as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we're heading that way. I give it about 10 years, and we're going to have TVs that are going to be phenomenal. And they're going to be smaller, but they're going to project out maybe 2 to 3 feet, and you're going to see almost like a holographic version of it. That's why they came out with the curved screen, mm-hmm. to give you that in advance. But they're going to eliminate that. I think they're heading that way now. I follow some of the advancements, and I mean, the young folks today, they're very smart when it comes to technical, and I think we're going the right way with that. And it's only going to help with the paranormal. Don't get me wrong, it's probably going to be terribly expensive. Give it a few years to come down, and I think we're going to be looking really good.
Tell me about some of your first experiences involving picking up EVPs or capturing anything on film that really, beyond having the interest, beyond, you know, writing about it, beyond just having that passion. What were some of those things that happened to you as you began to investigate that really solidified it for you even more so to say, this is interesting, there's something here? What were you picking up? What were you experiencing?
And it goes back to my very first night investigating. The evidence that we captured that night, or I should say that day, was incredible. To hear these voices, to see an image standing in a doorway that was taken up by photography, and it was mind-blowing. The EVP, back then they didn't call them electronic voice phenomena. It was more of what it was saying, because it was intelligent. It answered the question. And my professor asked the entity, why are you here? And it answered back,
mm-hmm.
to hurt you. And it said that, to hurt you. And when we played back the cassette later, I looked at everyone, and I must have been pitch white. Because to hear a voice saying that we can't see, that we can't hear with the naked ear, that it wants to hurt us, was mind-blowing. And you see everyone in the room thinking nothing of it. They're writing it down. Okay, it said it wanted to hurt us. Did it hurt anyone? No one was hurt. And that's where I started thinking logical, and hopefully that impressed some of the professors, where I said, well, maybe it's not on the same clock we are. We end an investigation after a few hours. We go home. Are they still on it? Are they still pursuing us? Like 2 weeks later, are we going to get hurt by this entity?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd see the professors, they would lean back and stare at me and say, good point. We never thought of it that way. And I felt like I was one of the group. I mean, here I am, 17, 18 years old, trying to fit in with these college professors who are in their 30s and sure. 20s. But that one right there, that pulled me in. That really pulled me in, because I really wanted to go back to this location, this home, and continue to ask this entity why they wanted to hurt us, why they wanted to do this. I just didn't want to step in anyone's feet. I knew they had a job to do, and I never found out what they caught the second time around. We all had graduated from school. We moved on, went to college. We did our own things, and I never came back to ask those questions. And I kind of regret that, because my professor is long past now, and that's something I would have loved to have asked him. What was the final conclusion on this home?
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Joe Pieri. In part two, what does Joe believe was haunting one of his first apartments? Will we be able to communicate almost like a phone call at some point in time with the other side? How has mainstream science adapted to paranormal research? And if someone wanted to start investigating today, what is the simplest way to start effectively? Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.